Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Brandon Winnerty, who is an author on the Star Wars Encyclopedia, one of several authors. This is a big, massive tome. It's like the Encyclopedia Britannica. You could not have one person write the whole thing, but he's one of the experts that has been called in to help out with it. Brandon, thank you for being on the show today.
Sonny, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So I got to say here, people aren't going to be able to see this, but I'm going to hold it up to the camera so you can see it. You know,
cause right. You're,
but this is a big, heavy book. I bought this so I could do this episode and, you know, talk authoritatively about it.
Sure.
But I'm going to give this to my kids for Christmas because this is like a big, hefty thing. It's the sort of thing that they'll take into their beds and like read night after night after night, which is the sort of thing I would do with something
exactly
like this. Did you grow up reading things like the, I mean, obviously not this specific one, but things like this, you know, resource books, guidebooks for the various nerd enterprises that we love.
Oh, yeah. It is. There was actually a book called The Star Wars Encyclopedia 20 years ago, 30 years ago, which is not this book, obviously, but it was written by Steve Sansweet, who is the Guinness Book World Record holder for the most Star Wars collectibles owned. Anyway, he has his bona fides. But that was one I remember I checked out from the library all the time. And I was like, I'm going to memorize all of this and I'm going to be the expert. I did not do that, but here I am. So something worked out. But it was like you were something, there's something childlike about like wanting to like know nitty gritty like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think books like that are really, really fun, really impactful.
Yeah. No, I remember, again, I just from my own nerd childhood, I had the Next Generation, one of those. Star Trek The Next Generation, but it was like, I think it was more than just Star Trek The Next Generation. I think it also had some Deep Space Nine, like the first couple seasons of Deep Space Nine. It was just a wonderful thing to sit in bed and read all the time. All right, so let's talk your background here, because I want folks to get to know you and how you kind of came to do this, because I get asked a question a lot, how do I get into writing? And I never know what to tell people, because it's the universe is much different now than when I kind of got started, and now I don't have to get started anymore. I don't know how to do it. But this is, I feel like you have really, you're a digital native. You've kind of come up through the ranks. How did you get started on the path to being an author on the Star Wars Encyclopedia?
It's a great question, and I also get that question a lot from people who kind of want to, you know, participate in this environment. And I think it all starts with, like you're saying, it was just me being plugged in to social or to the digital landscape of pop culture in a way that before all these, you know, Twitter accounts and things, it was more me and a buddy started a website specifically for pop culture in Dallas, and that kind of evolved. And Star Wars specifically, we started a podcast, still exists, Talking Bay 94, where I interviewed people that worked on Star Wars. And that was all it was. It wasn't me pontificating about, you know, The Last Jedi or anything like that. But it was just one-on-one interviews with cast and crew. And that then turned, it was around COVID, where I was like, I could probably turn this into written pieces, right? They were pretty in-depth and they were pretty focused on these specific characters. And I was like, oh, this is actually fitting very well in. We mentioned the encyclopedia earlier, but another one of these resources I grew up reading was the Star Wars Insider, which was the official Star Wars magazine. And so I knew that that was an article that kind of already existed. That was a type of thing that already was very much needed. And so I took it upon myself to just kind of transcribe and turn a few of my episodes into actual articles. And it took me a while, and I found the editor, and I kind of soft-pitched myself, but with pretty specific examples of what this could look like in Star Wars Insider. And he responded, and again, this is not this is not advice, because editors are very busy. But it wasn't a time where it was COVID, and it was kind of an industry reeling with itself. And they were very responsive, and they really liked what I did. And I was kind of plugged in almost immediately to turn in interviews. And so I was kind of proven already that I could, in a professional way, talk to these people without it being too much of a fanboy, with it still being researched. And it kind of turned into there where I did a lot for Star Wars Insider officially, and that turned into StarWars.com officially. And I was still doing the podcast at the same time. And then that turned into a call from DK while I was overseas, actually in London. And I was able to meet with them, and they kind of said, hey, do you want to contribute to this thing that we're putting together, the Star Wars Encyclopedia? And so it took about 5 or 6 years to get to even this point, which is, compared to a lot of other people in the space, a very, very small, you know, contribution, part of it all. But it is very nice being kind of an official in the official mix for a lot of these things.
I want to emphasize one specific thing that you talked about here, which is interviewing people. Lot of people want to write opinion pieces, for lack of a better word. They want to write reviews, or they want to write, you know, a think piece or whatever. And they don't often think that what people are interested in is interviews with specific people. But that really is, I think, the only piece of advice I give folks is you need to be able to talk to people who actually know something about the universe you want to cover. You need to be able to interview folks. Could you give some examples of, like, folks you called up for Talking Bay? And, yeah, like, sure. You know, because it's, again, it's not like you're not talking to, like, Mark Hamill, right? It's right, like, no. It's like smaller guys who still have very interesting stories to tell.
For sure. And I do want to say, too, I do think that it's a very interesting way to approach, I hate saying content or media or anything like that, but having that backbone of here are the people who are actually making something in a creative output does, I don't want to say it loosens my expectations or anything like that, but it does help me enjoy a lot of things a lot more, where I'm like, oh, this did require some craft. This did require some effort. And that really has informed kind of how I approach Star Wars, especially, where the people that I've talked to kind of range from the most obscure background alien creature performer to a lot of Academy Award winners, especially on the special effects side. That's kind of my bread and butter of the Industrial Light and Magic Titans, the Dennis Murins, the Phil Tippetts. And those are the people that I gravitated towards growing up, right? Obviously, I loved Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher and George Lucas, but it were these kind of books that we were talking about earlier that would mention the model makers or the shipbuilders or the special effects people. And I was like, oh, these are really interesting, really passionate, really creative people that pushed movies in a very certain way. And so over the past half decade that I've been talking to these people, it really has informed, again, not only how I watch movies, but how I appreciate them. And then that also then helps kind of establish a sense of both interest, but also expertise that I think a lot of people kind of shy away from or just focus on, you know, the bright colors. And so that really has helped me, especially kind of niche myself in the kind of this infrastructure, but also, again, appreciate. So you asked for specifics. So Dennis Murin and Phil Tippett are the two biggest examples that come to mind. Dennis Murin has the most Oscars of any living person, right? And he kind of pushed forward the special effects industry by decades. And then Phil Tippett is obviously, he invented a thing called Go Motion, which is stop motion, but really focused on it looking very, very lifelike. And that was employed first in Empire Strikes Back. And so again, he is kind of the godfather of effects as we know it, in that capacity. And so people like that. And then if you go on the opposite side and you think of, oh, who are the craziest aliens that have been doing the convention circuit for 30 years, right? That's also kind of a sweet spot for me where, again, they don't get to talk that much. And mm-hmm. so they have these stories that are really, not covered anywhere. And any of these books I have behind me or anything like that. And so that's always been very exciting.
Yeah. No, I mean, the Phil Tippett talk was pretty interesting. Like, again, he's a guy whose name you might recognize, and there's this great coffee table kind of art book that he put out a couple of years ago with just like archival stuff from Star Wars, but also like RoboCop and other projects he's worked on. That's really interesting. But like you say, these guys all have interesting stories. Everybody has a story to tell.
Right.
That's kind of what it comes down to. With something like this.
And again, especially with something, it's so funny talking about Star Wars in this way because it has become this like monoculture content apparatus, you know, but at the end of the day, it was one movie that came out 40 years ago that has really shaped almost everything that we know about blockbusters or movie making or anything like that. And so being able to delve into these little small pockets of it beyond just the overall George Lucas monomyth that he has told about the creation of these movies really does kind of, again, paint these interesting pictures of the last 40 years of movie making, because all these people went to work in all these other little avenues. And so a lot of the movies that we associate, you know, from Jurassic Park to Avengers to whatever it is with these new blockbusters, all have kind of the same fingerprints on the same people. So again, it is telling cinema history in a very specific way, but it gets to the end result very quickly.
Yeah. What are some of the through lines that you've seen from, you know, talking to Star Wars folks who've worked on other projects? Like, I mean, obviously there's the special effects work, which, you know,
sure.
Industrial Light and Magic and, you know, you Skywalker Ranch. Like, I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, stuff you can discuss there, but it, as you say, it has kind of changed how movies look, how they feel, how they're marketed, how they're released. What are some of the big ideas you've seen kind of come up again and again through your interviews?
Yeah, one of the things that pops up a lot, especially with the people that worked on the early movies, there's a guy called Roger Christian, and he actually won an Oscar for the original Star Wars movie as a set decorator. Mm-hmm. And his first movie, he won Academy Award for Star Wars, and then immediately after Star Wars went and worked on Alien.
Mm-hmm.
And so both of those movies, for Star Wars, he created the lightsaber. He's the one that took the piece of camera flash equipment and was like, oh, this looks like it could be an Excalibur. And then also contributed to the, they call it used universe, right? It's dirty. They tumbled R2-D2 in the sand for a while until it wasn't shiny and new. And then he immediately took those ideas, the Millennium Falcon interior, and then turned that into the Nostromo as well, right? And those two movies, I think, have informed, even if you look at this year, with what we're getting, we get Romulus, we get all these Star Wars things. But
yeah.
That used universe idea did not exist before. It only had 2001 as an example before that. And now you look at it and you're like, oh, that is kind of what we associate with this like hard, dirty sci-fi. That again, only a very small crew, him and his team and his boss kind of put together. And so those kind of people, again, have kind of directly tied into what we think of. And then another example is a guy named Craig Miller. Craig Miller was the head of the Star Wars fan club in 78, 79. And he, would write all these letters back to fans and would sign his name as Darth Vader when kids would respond. But it was this early time with him and his boss, Charles Lippincott, who just passed away. They were the ones that first marketed to Comic-Con, right? They took Star Wars to San Diego Comic-Con in 1976, and they said, hey, there's a movie coming out next year. We're bringing this guy, Mark Hamill, with us. We're going to show you 10 slides of what it looks like. And again, you think about what we do now, this mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. conglomerate of we're going to Hall H and we're doing all these things, started in a very specific way, in a very small way, to say, hey, we're having a Star Wars fan club. We're going to be telling people what's going to be happening. This is before, obviously, the internet. It was even less so in magazines and things like that. And so it was communicating to this like specific nerd fandom that wasn't really necessarily being served besides it was like Star Wars or Star Trek fanzines were kind of the only way people communicated. And then you had kind of that advent of Starlog and Fangoria that then they would plug very much into and write letters and do all these things. And so I think those two, if you kind of take it in a global scale, the past 40 years beyond the ILMs of it all, really have kind of affected how we approach movies and especially that genre.
Yeah. The Roger Christian's book is great. I was looking behind me on my shelf to see if I could find it, but it really is a fascinating look at a very specific moment, and his career is, you know, spans beyond that. But that one moment in particular was really interesting. And the Comic-Con thing is fascinating too, because I learned about that for the first time just a couple of years ago. I was reading some book that Star Wars, you know, went to early San Diego Comic-Con, and like was the comic out before that, before the movie came out?
It was out before the movie came out. It wasn't during that time, but that was also, again, you're talking about something very specific where this guy Charlie Lippincott, who did press for multiple movies of this caliber after the fact, I think he did like Superman, and but he identified that one of the ways that you can get the word out of movies before it even comes out or before it's, you know, going to be happening is getting a comic book adaptation makes people feel like this is a bigger deal than it is. And that was a time also when Stan Lee and Marvel, they were fine, but it wasn't necessarily like the global enterprise that it is today. And so they were able to negotiate a term where they had the Star Wars movie already in comic book adaptation form. They had a paperback version of the movie novelization, which again was relatively rare for the time. that came out at the same time. And then they had the idea for the action figures, and that's obviously the story of the early bird figures where they weren't going to be ready. They didn't know it was going to be a success, but they had the piece of paper that said, hey, if you buy this now, you'll get it in 6 months, a year, and you get your early bird certificate to get your first four figures. And so again, all these things that we consider almost like a trope or a rote thing to do now to market your movies, of having toys ready or tie-ins ready or a press tour ready, were kind of revolutionized by that original Star Wars more than most movies at that time.
So what you're saying is the reason I walk into Target now and I see shelves of Wicked dolls and Stanleys and everything else is because of Star Wars. That's it.
That's what's to blame at this point.
The novelization and comic book also just, again, it just jumps out at me as this kind of very interesting thing that is similar to what happens now, but it's also very different, right? Like now you have people who are terrified of spoilers. You know, you don't want plot details to leak. You don't want any of that stuff happening. And back in the day, it was just like, here's the whole movie in book form, like 2 months before the movie comes out. That's very different.
And again, another person I've talked to, Alan Dean Foster, is the one who pretty much wrote all of those tie-in novelizations in the 70s and 80s, right? If you look at anything on your shelf or anything you've ever picked up, he's like, oh yeah, this guy wrote these. And it is this mark of trust between the audience and the filmmaker. And especially it was during a time when you couldn't immediately go back and rewatch it or anything like that. And so you have these people who, not only the books, but people always talk to me about the trading cards too, or like this way of people like identifying back with the movie in a way that they could remember it, that they could learn. And a lot of these things that people still hold on to really comes from action figure backing and trading card descriptions, right? These things that like, you're like, oh yes, Walrus Man. How do I know this name? It's because it was on a action figure. And you're like, yes, of course, my friend Hammerhead. Like it is something that we're missing, I think, in this time where, again, Skeleton Crew is coming out right now. There are some toys that you can pre-order, but it does take 6 months to a year just with how things are marketed, how things are viewed, how things are embargoed, that you're not necessarily getting it until much after the show or movie comes out. And so I think there is less time for audiences, especially children, to kind of latch on to these ideas. And that's where something like Wicked is so interesting, where you almost got like a... The Phantom Menace was the example where it's just like a glut of merchandise when the movie came out, right? It was every single fast food restaurant, every single Frito-Lay bag had Jar Jar Binks on it. And you're like, yes, of course, my friend Newt Gunray from Phantom Menace. And so some of that was not that successful because those characters maybe didn't hit the 25-year-old as well, and it wasn't necessarily as interesting for the 9-year-old because they didn't care about tax or trade routes or something like that, right? But it is still an interesting shift that we've made in just how we consume our culture and how we consume, like, this, again, content, quote unquote, where there's not as much marketing to children, I think. And I think that's something we forget about Star Wars. Like, it is for kids.
Yeah.
In the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. I will say, it's funny. My kids are Star Wars fans. They like Star Wars. But the first time that they have seen an ad for something and been like, I want to watch this Star Wars show, not the movies, but the Star Wars show, was the Skeleton Crew.
Yeah,
ads, because it's like a bunch of kids having a kids adventure. They're like, can we watch that? I was like, yeah, we can. Let me check it out first, just to make sure. You know, you're still young. Yeah. I gotta guide you here. But I do think it's interesting. And one thing that you kind of keyed on here that I just want to really emphasize is the importance of trivia. The importance of trivia. And you know, you say like, oh, trivia. You know, that's it's trivial, right? That's where the word derives from. But it is not trivial to the people who are into this sort of thing. It's fun. It's like a fun way to immerse yourself in the universe and experience it in a slightly more intense, sometimes slightly silly, but also like really entertaining way.
Yeah, I do think it's. I do. I'm glad that you said that it's like silly and fun, because I do think that there is a new avenue now and on YouTube and how people are like consuming this, where there's such a like a appreciation slavish, you know, need to adhere to lore. This word lore is almost something, as someone that helped write this book, I almost like cringe at the word lore, because that almost makes it like a codified sort of thing. And again, we're talking about Star Wars, and you can do be very, very specific there, where a lot of this was flying on the seat of its pants, right? In terms of what it was establishing, and, you know, between 4 and 5 is a huge jump in terms of what world building there was. Mm-hmm. And then 5 to 6 is a huge world building jump. And then you have this time between Return of the Jedi and Phantom Menace, where it was like the Wild West, where George Lucas was very hands-off. He had no idea what was going on. And then Phantom Menace comes out and retcons a lot of those things, right? He brings in a couple ideas from the books, but really he kind of just makes up his own stuff. And then you have to readhere all these different ideas of lore. So you look at Star Wars on a 45-year history, and there are some people that expect it to all be very similar and all be coalescing and all these things. And there is this element, especially when you're putting a book like this together, of making sure all that makes sense. And I know so much of it that I do like kind of including little fun nods or something like that to something that might've happened 50 years ago. But there is this element of a lot of people are more keyed into the lore rather than the story being told. Mm-hmm. And so it's like this weird balance of, I would almost rather have a good Star Wars story that introduces new things to canon than reflect something that happened 20 years ago in a book that, again, I read and love and I have behind me on the shelf, right? And like, what I've noticed too, and then not to like oversimplify or anything like that, but there are a lot of people who almost just watch lore videos or just read Wikipedia and don't actually like the content or like the movies or TV shows or anything, or haven't read them or haven't done anything. They're just like, oh yes, I'm aware of this concept because I saw a 20-minute YouTube video. Again, a lot of those people who make those YouTube videos are very good friends of mine, but they've done the research. They've right. actually read the books. They've actually done. So you're getting like secondhand information. And again, what you realize when you're putting together a book like this, that a lot of this has kind of been like a game of telephone over the years. And so if you go back to the actual source material and then you're putting it together and you're writing it and you have a character count and you have these limitations, there's a lot that can be either not understood or completely glossed over, or it gets kind of run of the mill. And so it's very interesting to kind of, again, separate the lore from the story and let the lore inform the story rather than it just being kind of like a Wikipedia article of yeah. what's happening. I think is kind of an interesting thing at the moment that's happening, whether it's Star Wars or Lord of the Rings is a good example. I think this movie that came out this weekend, for what it is, right, it's a solid B-minus movie, but people are like, oh, I can't believe it's only 2 pages of Tolkien material. I'm like, well, yeah, like I understand that as a huge Tolkien fan, mm-hmm. but you can only do so much with when you're constrained by lore, and when you say that is the end all be all, you know. And so comparing Tolkien to Lucas is interesting, because Lucas truly doesn't care. He has truly no idea about anything in this book, if I'm going to be honest. Like Lucas, if he looked through this, he's like, I don't know who these characters are, right? And so it's interesting to kind of understand that there's been a lot of different hands, a lot of different people in this mix who have been putting this together for 40 years and choosing what's the best and letting it tell a larger story.
Yeah. I want to get to the book in a second, because this is the reason I have you on the show today, talk about the book. But sure. But it is interesting just to some of the, what you're describing calls to mind like comic book guy from The Simpsons, right?
Sure.
Like the sort of guys who are like, actually, Newt Gunray said this in episode 1, whatever. Like there is a whole cadre of like actually artists who are, you know, yeah. like always looking to, you know, have the intellectual high ground, and they are tiresome in their own way.
And I will give it to comic book guy. He at least read the comic books. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that's the other,
yeah.
Again, I hate being like on a high horse or convoluted, but like, again, I read a lot of this whole shelf behind me is just boxes of comic books that I've actually read, that I actually read all the time. And so again, comic books are a great example of lore driven, cameo driven character thing, where they're like, yes, I've seen that costume, I know this person, I played him in a video game once, I hate what they did to this, I hate this actor, I hate what the costume, all these little minutiae of, again, people, I hate to say fake fans, but like, it's how people are consuming is very different than it was even 20 years ago. And it is just kind of an interesting mix where, again, you're looking at James Gunn's comments underneath his tweets, and you get like kind of depressed. You're like, oh, like this sucks. Yeah. Like no matter if they're right or wrong, you're like, how you're approaching this is in such bad faith sometimes because you're viewing it through the lens of a lore video or a Wikipedia entry or a meme screenshot you saw of this character. And it's almost like a disheartening way to approach anything. But then especially in this like omniculture, Marvel, DC, Disney of it all, it's pretty wild.
Yeah, no, there was a to hop off of Star Wars and over to DC for a second. There was a funny video where, you know, James Gunn was like, you know, people complain to me and they say that this is not what happened in the movies, and I have to remind them that this is all fake. This is great. We can make it up as we go along. It's, you know, and you know, look, part of the appeal of something like Star Wars, again, moving from movies to books to video games to the cartoons to the TV shows, there is some consistency. There's like this idea of like a, you know, a unified universe where it's all, but at the same time, it is all.
It's faking in space is what I think. Is that Harrison Ford that said that? It's faking in space, yeah. Which I'm like, great. Yes, I agree. And again, I don't want to like besmirch or undercut the importance of something being connected and it all like telling this larger story. Because that is, again, like what you're saying, that's what makes Star Wars especially exciting, where you're like, yes, I'm traveling with this character. I know these worlds. I understand the basic underlying scientific, pseudoscientific principles that, you know, are underlying through all these storytelling. So I'm not going to be able to guess where the story is going, but hopefully the story makes sense with the world that has been created, right? And I think that is the most important part. But then once you start getting into, again, the minutiae of like, oh, like this was slightly different, or I can't believe that they, then all of a sudden you're not seeing the forest for the trees, right? Or whatever the vice versa of that is, where you're really focused on these little small things as opposed to larger character stories or arcs that are kind of important throughout this whole storytelling process. And I think that's where some people get a little lost.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so the encyclopedia, the first thing that jumped out at me when I cracked it open was, wait, I don't understand how this is laid out. Because I just opened it to a random page. Yeah, yeah. Like, and it wasn't alphabetical, it wasn't. And then I realized I went back to the start. I started at the beginning, as one should do with a book. And realized that it's laid out as characters appear in the universe, right? That's an interesting choice.
Yeah, and it's also separated slightly. It's like character section, I believe like ship section, and then planet section as well. And all of them are told pretty much chronologically. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. And again, when we put it together, it was kind of all at once, right? For instance, I did all of The Rise of Skywalker. Mm-hmm. And so you just do all of them all combined. You do the ships and the people and the planets all together. And then when it's laid out, it's a little bit different, obviously, with just characters and then just ships. And just I will say I was kind of put on the spot a couple weeks ago during a live show, and I was having to find something, and it did actually make it pretty easy to find it. So like it's interesting because part of you feels like, oh, this should be maybe alphabetical or this should be chronological, but with everything combined. But it does actually once you're trying to like do it for like actual research or actual it does actually make it kind of an interesting, quick resource.
Well, and also I could just imagine, again, I can imagine, you know, my 9-year-old sitting down to read this book and just like reading it like the story of Star Wars almost, right? Like there's a sense to which that does actually make a lot of sense if you are just sitting down to read it as like as entertainment instead of as a, you know, resource, instead of as like an actual, instead of as one would use an encyclopedia. If it's just its own discrete, you know, kind of entertaining book, it's a very smart way to lay it out. I got to give them credit.
Well, they also, there was the same publisher, I did not work on this book, called Star Wars Timelines by DK. It came out about a year ago. And that was a resource that we used a lot during the production of this book because it was a lot of the same team. And they put together, it was truly a chronology. Like if you look at that book, it's almost like to the minute of like, hey, here's when things are happening from what the creation of the galaxy to the most up-to-date moment that we have. And, that informed a lot as well, because again, a lot of things can be retrofitted or, you know, slotted into their appropriate times. And it does add a lot of context to these, like, you know, you're looking at a comic, you're looking at a book, and you're looking at a movie, like when does this all take place? And it is kind of an interesting, again, way to contextualize Star Wars specifically as this like huge tapestry of storytelling of it being strictly chronological.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you're sitting down to, all right, so you have the Rise of Skywalker, that's your assignment area. When you're sitting down to write entries for this, was there like a list? Did you have like a, did they say, all right, you need to do entries for all of these people? Or was it more like, I'm going to watch it and pull out some interesting things and that's what I'm going to write about? How did that work?
It was a combination of both, but with the majority of it being that first part, which is there was a list. And that list came from Lucasfilm, it came from the publisher, and it's called a synopsis, right? It's just like, hey, here is truly a Google Doc list, and it has everyone's name next to it, of just like, hey, here's the type, the character, you know, is it a character, ship, or planet? Here's how many words it needs to be, and here's the general vibe of it, right? And that's for every single additional new entry that needs to exist. From there, though, and that's been pulled from a variety of sources. You can even just imagine it in your mind, right? There's the primary, here are your 20 main characters, here are your 50 supporting characters, here are the things that have been made into toys already, right? Here are things that already have entries elsewhere. And then there was an opportunity to say, hey, here are the people that might need to be added, here's what's not really that important right now, those kind of things. And so that was also part of our job, was to say, hey, here's the things that need to be included. But for the most part, it was a pretty comprehensive list to begin with. And then, yeah, it was kind of just, I think I watched Rise of Skywalker 30 times, 40 times. Like, it was a lot. It was a lot. I've been Stockholm syndrome a little bit, to be like, it's great. I really, you know. So, yeah, it's a very interesting process, because then you're all in the same shared Google Doc. And you're just like, okay. And then you're putting your entries in separate drives and stuff. But you can see kind of the progress of everybody and seeing what's being added. And it's this really interesting living document with a lot of real experts. Really fascinating.
Yeah. When you're sitting down to actually write the entry, what is that process like? Because obviously, you have to mention where they are, what planet they're on, you know, what ship they're on, et cetera. But like, what was the... how do I put this? How did you bring them to life? Put it that way.
Yeah. So it's an interesting, these DK books have been written in various capacities and various titles since, I think, 1995. The Visual Dictionary is what they were called then. And they did it first for the original trilogy. And actually, I just interviewed the guy who did the first one. And that was when DK was pretty much just like historical driven books. Yeah. Right? It was like, hey, here's a World War II book. Here is a book about castles or whatever it is. And then it was these little lines pointing to different things. Here's the drawbridge. Here's what a catapult is. And then they were like, we should do this for Star Wars. And Star Wars was a rich enough and deep enough story and world that you could pontificate against that, right? You go, hey, here's how lightsaber works. Here's why this TIE fighter has these two sides, right? So this guy, his name is David West Reynolds. He's a doctor. He's a doctor of archaeology. Put this first one together. And if you read that first one and then you read this encyclopedia, the tone is the same. The way it's written is the same. It's familial. It's interesting, but it takes it very seriously. It's almost like being taught. If a teacher is trying to make this as approachable as possible, but still it's scientific, it's historical. And so then when you're 20 years past that, 30 years past that, and you're writing it for The Rise of Skywalker, so to speak, you have to research. It's all, has this been noted anywhere else? And so if there's a character, a good example is Keri Russell's character from Rise of Skywalker, Zori Bliss, had never appeared in anything else. Zori Bliss is just in Rise of Skywalker. She's in it for 5 minutes. And you're like, okay, where has she been before? And so you have to kind of backtrack and you say, let's look at the Rise of Skywalker novelization. Let's see what was talked about her there. Let's see what was mentioned in any comic books she might have appeared in since. Any, you know, ancillary media. There's a bunch of other guidebooks and visual dictionaries that have happened in the past. Pablo Hidalgo is kind of the keeper of it all now, who writes the new ones. And so anything that has been written about her before is considered canon. So when you're researching, it is, first it's just kind of an info dump. You're like, okay, here are 50 different things about Zori Bliss that have occurred over the past 3-4 years. You put it all in the document and then you have to kind of sift it out. And again, it's kind of just research. And it's kind of just like putting any piece of research together, and then you have your character count, you have the things that are the most important to the character, the most interesting if you're reading this as a kid or as someone doing some research, and it's kind of just a give and take. But then again, a character count really does demand, you know, only the biggest highlights, but then you do want to incorporate as much as possible from the other ancillary stuff just to make it feel all holistic. But you just kind of go from there. And a lot of times, you know, you have your basic, hey, here's their species, here's their home world, here, you know, the little bullets that each one gets. But then some of them don't have that. Some of them need species names or need, you know, additional information. And so that's an opportunity to, sometimes the author gets to create it. Sometimes you just mark it in red and give it to Lucasfilm and say, yeah. Like, I trust you more than me here. or you give them a suggestion or two and it gets incorporated or it doesn't. But it's very, again, kind of cumbersome for each one, especially the smaller characters, which get, like, if you get two lines somewhere in a random, again, it's lucky I've been preparing for this for a very long time, where, you know, I have all these books already. So I was able to kind of go into my actual library, which is maybe the best feeling in the world, to be like, I bought this 3 years ago, and now I'm actually using this. It was worth it. But yeah, it's a really interesting kind of intensive process for each one.
I have to say, I moved like 4 or 5 years ago, and I was working on a piece. I was like, oh, I need that from this book that I gave away to the library when I moved.
And stupid. Never give away a book is what I've learned.
I never give away a book. Never give away. Keep them forever. There's a reason that they have bookshelves in houses.
Yes.
So my knowledge here may be out of date. I may be working from bad info here, but my understanding years ago was that Lucasfilm has like a Bible of like, holocron. Here are all of the characters, and it's kind of ranked by, you know, importance and or organized by importance, and, you know, how much is like canon versus like kind of soft canon. And do they still have that? Is that is that,
so that is kind of the canon levels is kind of, it's a, you know, there's part of it that's like very consumer friendly is the wrong word. Like, it's kind of been like defined in a very certain way, which is like, here is, I think it was like a canon was whatever George Lucas has said, whatever has been in any of George Lucas's movies. And then Clone Wars was the top level of canon because that was something that Lucas touched every single day. Right. And then there were the further canons of like, okay, then you have, you know, the books, right? And that's a little lower. And then you have, you know, comic books are still in there. And then you have things like non-canon, very obvious things like, I mean, not even that obvious, but you would think like Robot Chicken, Star Wars, technically was correct in a lot of it, right? But is not actually canon, right? But you can sometimes people like to pull things or like make a joke. And then you have Legends, right? So Legends is anything pre the Disney sale. And again, that's a lot of these books and a lot of these video games and comic books. And then post 2015, then there was kind of a new canon established and all of those were relegated to Legends. Mm-hmm. But again, those have a lot of the times been re-canonized in various ways. The biggest example is obviously Thrawn, the blue-skinned admiral from the Ahsoka show, is in live action. He's been in the shows. He is canon. He had a bunch of books. And some of his stuff is a little different, but he's pretty much the same character. And all of that is kind of housed in this, it's called the Holocron. It's hosted on these internal Lucasfilm servers that I've never seen. it's run by a guy named Leland Chee and then Pablo Hidalgo. And it's pretty bare bones. It's a pretty, it's data-driven images, important information, species, general stories, things that you can connect. But mostly so you just don't run over your own foot. And then also, if you're trying, the big examples that have come up over the years has been when a new filmmaker comes in to say, hey, we would like to make this movie. We would like to use this kind of character. We're going to make it from scratch. The Holocron is able to come back and say, oh, we actually kind of already have a character that might fit in really well with what you're planning, or a type of droid that fits in really well without you having to create something from whole cloth. And so that's kind of how it's used. And I think, and again, talking about what we were saying earlier about like, how lore informs story rather than story inform lore, I think that's a really kind of effective way to tell story at the moment.
Yeah. I do love the visual image of, you know, the Star Wars servers, the Holocron being in like the Lucasfilm skiff, you know, the secure information center, you know, the nobody can get in with a phone or a thumb drive or anything like that.
It's that Kyle Newman movie. It's Fanboys all over again.
Yeah. All right. Let me see. What else? So who was your favorite character from Rise of Skywalker to research and write up?
Ooh, that's a great question. A character called Claude, who was in a bunch of the trailers and imagery for Rise of Skywalker, and then ends up being it for truly like 3 seconds. If you look up Claude, K-L-A-U-D, he is this like, he looks like a Hutt, really, except he is also a mechanic, but he doesn't really have any arms. So you're like, how are you fixing the Millennium Falcon if you can't touch anything? So he was a really fun one to kind of... Again, a lot of stuff has been talked about of Claude already, so it's just fun to kind of put it all together. A similar one is at the very end of Rise of Skywalker, in a little fan service-y way, they brought back Warwick Davis to be Wicket, the Ewok, and watch the next explosion happen above Endor. But then they also brought Warwick Davis's son, Harrison, to play in the scene with him, to play Wicket's son, Pommet. So I was able to write the entry for Pommet Warwick, which was a nice moment for me. And again, a lot of stuff was already there, but then you include stuff about, you know, them believing in a golden god still, or like all these little things that kind of tie back. And again, tie back to things that I love in Star Wars. And so, talking about how much I love the aliens and the creatures and the little weird guys, it's always fun to kind of bring them to life, even in the tiniest bit, because a lot of it has already been established.
Yeah, yeah. That's so funny. Maybe there's no good answer to this, but yeah, what was your least favorite thing to research on this?
That's interesting. One of the other sections that I really was focused in on were the comic books, which I love. I've read most of them, so Marvel's been putting them out since the Disney acquisition, and there's just so much to dive into. And it's very interesting with comics because a lot of them are comic only characters, right? They've never really appeared anywhere else. But there is an opportunity to kind of derive a lot more from the character when you're actually reading it. And again, talking about what is already out there and then what is actually on the page are two very different things. And so a lot of it does require, because you say like, oh, this person is in this issue, but like they'll be in the background of something. And so you really have to kind of chase. And so it was almost like, I don't want to say it was an adventure, but it was really kind of, it was a big challenge to kind of trace these comic book specific characters throughout multiple iterations and tell a cohesive story. One of the interesting parts of that, though, that I still think about and I still get to do is a lot of the stuff we were working on hadn't necessarily come out yet, but we were given access to a lot of it in a very collaborative way. And a lot of that was kind of seeing early scripts and called bind-ups of these comics before they came out. And it was really, for me, as like kind of a aspiring writer or a writer, to see how other people have put together these stories for especially visual medium. But then again, trying to derive what the author's intent was ended up being pretty challenging for the comic book characters specifically.
Yeah. Did you guys have to, work in any of the video game stuff reading a comic, there may be a lot of them, but it's still, you know, it takes 10 minutes to read a comic. Playing a video game is an entirely different process.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I had video game entries for sure. And there are people kind of like how I had comics. People knew that I liked reading the comics. There are contributors who were the video game people. Okay, we're giving you these three video games. But when they would overlap with me, it was interesting because I don't have any of the systems. I have a Nintendo Switch. I don't have a PlayStation or an Xbox. I really haven't played any of these big, the Jedi Survivor games or anything like that as much as I would like to. And so a lot of that, a great resource is either, again, asking or the what's it called? It's not free play YouTube videos, but there are people that just record themselves playing these games online. And so if you have a pretty good idea of where this character appears in a game, right, especially if it's like a random ship, it's like, oh, this ship was on this level, then you can just watch that level and be like, oh, okay, yes, I'm aware of what's happening here. And then, of course, you cross-check and you make sure that wasn't just like that player's experience or something like that. But that's a huge resource of just, oh, yes, it has been pretty mapped out by very talented people to be able to to be able to slot in. The other part of video games too, beyond just double checking on these YouTube videos, is there are in-game data banks a lot in these Star Wars games, and those have already been written as well. So you're able to just kind of pull those directly for any already approved information.
Yeah. Well, that was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. I always do like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's anything folks should know about the Star Wars encyclopedia or fandom in general. What should you have asked, Sonny?
I don't know.
What
did you fail to ask? You asked me what my favorite entry was. You didn't necessarily ask me what my favorite Star Wars movie was. And I knew I shouldn't say Last Jedi. So I'm not, but it's not. Last Jedi is not my favorite Star Wars movie.
That's good. That's good.
It's like halfway. It's not even number one or two anymore.
Rise of Skywalker, number one.
Rise of Skywalker, number one. Phantom Menace is very high right now.
You're a child of the prequels. I mean,
I'm a child of the prequels, yes. It wasn't necessarily that high for a long time. And I think over the years, softened is even the wrong word, but I think if we go back to kind of this idea of movie making and Star Wars' place in it all, I think Phantom Menace, more than pretty much all of them, except maybe the original, is the only other one that has like changed movies and is also George Lucas's like solitary vision. And if you believe in like the auteur theory or anything like that, like it is kind of, that is George Lucas at his peak, peak auteur, right? His peak, no one was messing with him. No one was making him change anything. And it is pretty, it still really holds up, I think, in that capacity.
Yeah. I will say the prequel trilogy is interesting to look at these years later, just because it is, as you say, kind of solitary, unitary vision that a filmmaker had and was, it runs through the whole trilogy, even in a way that is not true for the original trilogy. Is not quite the same level or depth of control. It's interesting to go back and watch those movies, which I like some of them. I like Revenge of the Sith. That's a fun one.
Yeah, that's what everyone says. That's my least favorite prequel movie.
What?
Revenge of the Sith is my least favorite movie because it's the most, he had the most, not even hands in the kitchen, but it was, if you look at it and you're like, oh, it's so connected to the original trilogy, this is great. No, that's the worst part of it. The connectivity is the worst part of it, where he felt forced to like include these things that felt familiar and nice. Because like, if you look at Phantom Menace and even Attack of the Clones, you're like, this is all weird. I hate this, which is awesome. So I'm all for Star Wars pushing itself a little bit. And I think those first two especially really push Star Wars in a way that we are, even now with Mandalorian, his new ship is from Phantom Menace. We're kind of, I don't even want to say like nostalgically revisiting, but it has kind of overcome whatever 20 year ago, fandom issues it had, and now is kind of back in its place in the pantheon.
Yeah.
So we'll see if that happens with the new sequels. But I assume that if history has proven, I think it will. So
we'll certainly be fighting about them for the rest of our lives.
Right.
Brandon, thanks for being on. And I just want to plug, I want to plug this book again, the Star Wars Encyclopedia. I don't know if any folks out there remember, Brandon mentioned the DK like castle, the visual encyclopedias that they put out. Like I owned the castles book growing up. It was everything a 7-year-old could want to know about castles. I learned about portcullises and battlements and all that stuff. It was just a delightful thing. And this, again, it's just a really nice looking book. It's nice and big and heavy, and the pages are thick, and they're really well illustrated. It's really nicely laid out.
What about the words, Sonny? What about the well-written
ambivalent
words?
I'm ambivalent about the words. Some entries better than others. We'll see.
Sure.
But it's a really nice, interesting, good book. Again, if you have kids who love Star Wars, a very good Christmas gift. You still got a couple days here.
Yes, so. I just bought one for my mother-in-law last night. So that's what she's getting for Christmas.
That's nice.
That's not a joke. She put that on her list, and I was like, I can do that.
That's good.
Yeah, it was nice of her. She was like, I want a signed copy. And I was like, that's very nice of you to say. Anyway, yeah, you can get it on anywhere you buy books. It's there it is.
Yeah. Brandon, thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Sonny, for having me.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.